This is a recording of Who Was Sherem by A. Keith Thompson, published in Interpreter, a Journal of Mormon Scripture, read by Scott Dunaway. Abstract. The Book of Mormon's first Antichrist, Sherem, quote, came among, end quote, the Nephites before their first generation was ended. Because he was an eloquent believer in the law of Moses, there has been a variety of surmise as to his background. Was he a Lamanite, or a Jaredite, or a Mulekite trader? Was his presence among the separated Nephites evidence of early interaction between the Nephites and other civilizations in Nephite lands from the time of their first arrival? This short article reviews the various suggestions about Sherem's identity and suggests that he was most likely a descendant of the original Lehite party, but that his identity was purposely suppressed so as not to give him more credibility than he deserved. Sometime after Nephi's death, Jacob's doctrinal teaching and priestly authority were challenged by an eloquent believer in the law of Moses named Sherem. Sherem maintained that Jacob had perverted the law of Moses into the worship of a future Redeemer to be named Jesus Christ, a gospel that Sherem claimed was blasphemous. Jacob's record of Sherem's background has left many unanswered questions, since Jacob was said simply, quote, "There came a man among the people of Nephi whose name was Sherem," end quote. Sherem's objection to Jacob's interpretation of the law of Moses raises the question of what interpretation of that law was orthodox in Jerusalem in the 7th century B.C. That subject is beyond the immediate purpose of this article, but the writer and others have begun to explore elsewhere the influence of Judaism in the Book of Mormon, and there is no doubt that as a subject it has only begun to attract scholarly attention. In this article, however, the primary focus is on the preliminary question of Sherem's identity. Who was Sherem, and where did he come from? Was he a Nephite, a Lamanite, or someone else? Perhaps a wandering Jaredite or a Mulekite? Each of these ideas for Sherem's background has been proposed, as the reader will see in the discussion that follows. Sherem's identity seems the more mysterious when his, quote, arrival, end quote, is compared with Alma's account of Abinadi's presence among the people of King Noah in the land of Lehi-Nephi. For when Alma originally introduced Abinadi in his record, he did not say that Abinadi, quote, came among them, end quote, but that Abinadi was, quote, among them, end quote, and that he, quote, went forth among them and began to prophesy, end quote. Despite the slightly different descriptions of their origins, is it possible that, like Abinadi, Sherem was a Nephite, but the scripture editors had reasons to downplay those connections in Sherem's case? Reasons why the Book of Mormon editors may have wanted to downplay any Nephite connections that Sherem had include, that they did not provide Sherem with credibility, since in their eyes his message was apostate. In contrast, Abinadi was a preacher of whom those editors were proud. Other reasons why Sherem was more likely a Nephite than a Mulekite or a Jaredite include the text of the Book of Mormon itself, which suggests that the Nephite contact with or knowledge of those peoples came more than 300 years later. In fact, there is no mention of any direct Jaredite contact with the Nephites or Lamanites at all in the existing Book of Mormon text. The Book of Mormon suggests that the Nephites became aware of the Jaredites only when King Mosiah translated their record, after he joined the Nephite and Mulekite societies together sometime during the 2nd century B.C. There are also, quote, markers, end quote, in Jacob's account of his meeting with Sherem, which suggests that Sherem was more likely a Nephite than anyone else. Those markers include Sherem's eloquence in the Nephite language, his familiarity with the law of Moses, and the resonance of Sherem's doctrines with the ideas of the Deuteronomists, who some scholars say may have been part of the reason for Lehi's flight from Jerusalem. Those doctrines are said to have morphed into the literal Rabbinism that Christ decried during his mortal ministry more than 600 years later. This article therefore discusses the various existing theories about Sherem's identity, discounts them for the reasons summarized above, and concludes that Sherem was more likely a Nephite than a Lamanite, a Jaredite, or a Mulekite, or a member of any other group with whom these recorded peoples may have mixed when and after they arrived in the New World. As one of my anonymous reviewers has said, quote, "It's like Sherlock Holmes, eliminating all the possibilities, though without all the evidence, and accepting that what remains, however improbable it first may have seemed, as the real answer," end quote. After I have discussed the reasons why Sherem was likely a Nephite, I then consider how he might have learned his heretical anti-Christian ideas, since Nephi made it very clear that he had not taught his people the dark and abominable ways of the Jews. I then suggest that Sherem was likely a son or more remote descendant of Zoram, since though Zoram was a friend to Nephi, he was also a scribe, and likely familiar with those dark Jewish ways which were abominable in the eyes of his friend. I also explain that later Zoram might practice in theology, which is treated as apostate and heretical in the Book of Mormon, has a distinctly Deuteronomist and even rabbinical flavor. After reviewing the likely reasons for that, quote, "familiar spirit," end quote, I suggest that many of the anti-Christian threads in the Book of Mormon likely also have Zoramite origins. I also suggest that those anti-Christian connections may be the reason why Korihor died among the Zoramites, and why many Zoramites denied the Christ. Was Sherem a Jaredite or a Mulekite? The idea that Sherem may have been a Jaredite was suggested by Hugh Nibley in his classic Lehi in the Desert and the World of the Jaredites. He wrote that, quote, "Jaredite proper names have a peculiar ring of their own. Their most characteristic feature is the ending in M. This is called mimation and is actually found among the most ancient languages of the Near East," end quote. Alan C. Minor also points out, with an additional citation to Catherine Thomas, that, quote, "Sherem is similar to the name Shalem, Ether, chapter 3, verse 1. The name given to the mountain upon which the brother of Jared came to know the true nature of Jesus Christ," end quote. But Nibley's Ancient Languages of the Near East, end quote, comment does not exclude non-Jaredite Near Eastern connections for the name, quote, "Sherem," end quote. And Catherine Thomas's additional comments suggest the name more likely has Hebrew antecedents than anything unequivocally Jaredite. It also seems unlikely that a Jaredite would be well versed in the niceties of Mosaic law, since Moses was given that law after the Jaredites had left the Old World, or be superbly competent in the Nephite language, as Jacob said that Sherem was. Nor is Sherem's competence in the Nephite language and religion answered by Professor Sorensen's well-respected hypothesis that the Lehites and Mulekites did not arrive in the uninhabited lands. That is because it is unlikely that even the intelligent members of any other pre-existing cultural group present in the Promised Land, when the Lehites arrived, could have become as competent as Sherem was in the Nephite language and religion within one or two generations. Kevin Christensen's suggestion that Sherem may have been a Mulekite trader has more inferential material to support it. First, since Jacob was born shortly after his parents left Jerusalem around 600 BC, and since the Mulekite party likely left soon afterwards, this Jacob-Sherem meeting would have taken place within the first or second generation after both parties arrived in the New World. Since both parties would still have shared the same language and the law of Moses, then Sherem might have been a Mulekite, save for the fact that the Book of Mormon does not document any contact between either Nephites and Lamanites on the one hand and the Mulekites on the other, until Mosiah joined the Nephites and the Mulekites around the beginning of the 2nd century B.C. Christensen says that, quote, "Sherem talks like a Deuteronomist," end quote, and Jacob, quote, "like a First Temple priest," end quote, meaning that Jacob looks like an Israelite traditionalist who resisted the Deuteronomic reforms which Sherem was advocating. And it is this Deuteronomic message that Christensen can feel in Sherem, which leads him to his thesis of Amulekite origin for Sherem, since he finds it unlikely that an Orthodox Nephite would have promoted Deuteronomic heresy. While Christensen's solution to the identity of Sherem is better than Nibley's, since it provides Sherem with excellent Nephite language skills and religious understanding, his explanation for this Nephite-Mulekite contact 300 years before the Book of Mormon says it happened is less satisfactory. To shore up his, quote, Sherem was a Mulekite, end quote, hypothesis, Christensen cites Brant Gardner. Referring to the likely social history of the Nephites, Christensen says that Jacob may have been opposed to trade as the generator of the Nephite materialism, which he decries in his temple sermon. Christensen suggests that Sherem may have sought audience with Jacob to break down the trade barriers which Jacob's interpretation of the law of Moses was supporting. While Christensen's reasoning is imaginative, Sherem's alleged trade concern forms no part of Jacob's report of their dialogue. That is surprising if trade barriers were the real focus of the Jacob-Sherem meeting, since preaching against materialism was indeed a prominent part of Jacob's ministry, as evidenced in Jacob's chapter 1 and 2. Jacob prefers to report for his righteous posterity that the purpose of his meeting with Sherem was limited to the correct interpretation of the law of Moses. For Sherem, Jacob says that the Christ-centered gospel was blasphemy, but for Jacob, it is the non-negotiable core of true religion. Jacob testifies that he has received this knowledge of this gospel by revelation, and Jacob had the last word, since he was the author of the record, and reported that Sherem was smitten and died following his request for a sign and his confession. Was Sherem a Lamanite or a Nephite? Alan Miner dismisses the suggestion that Sherem might have been a Lamanite, since Sherem responded affirmatively to Jacob's question as to whether Sherem believed the scriptures. For Miner, this answer is, quote, damning, end quote, since the only scriptures known in the New World were the brass plates. Laman and Lemuel had never indicated any interest in them, and they were in Nephite custody at the time of the Jacob-Sherem meeting. This logic also weighs against Christensen's argument that Sherem was a Mulekite trader for three reasons. First, Amalekai's record says that Mulekites, quote, had brought no records with them, end quote. Second, Amalekai says that the Mulekites had lost their knowledge of their Creator because they brought no written scriptures with them. And finally, the Mulekites were solely reliant on their oral genealogy for their knowledge of their origins when Mosiah joined the two peoples together 300 years later, while a Deuteronomist Mulekite trader contemporary with Jacob might have retained some memory of the literal pre-rabbinic tradition before his forebears departed from Jerusalem. It is unlikely that anyone could have been as articulate and well-briefed as Sherem seems to have been, without detailed familiarity with the records held only by Nephi and his spiritual heirs. Is it then possible that Sherem could have been a member of the Nephite community that had separated from the Lamanites? There is controversy over the size of the Nephite party at the date of their separation from the Lamanites, and the date of the meeting between Jacob and Sherem. And the Book of Mormon text does not provide much material from which readers can draw a conclusion. It says that the Nephite party comprised Nephi and his family, quote, Zoram and his family, and Sam, mine elder brother, and his family, and Jacob and Joseph, my younger brethren, and also my sisters, all of those who would go with me, end quote. These 7 to 10 or 12 families composed the original Nephite group. These were, quote, those who believed in the warnings and revelations of God, end quote, and, quote, hearkened unto Nephi's words, end quote. Even though a third generation could have been well established before Sherem came among them, the core of the Nephite group appears to have originated from fewer than 15 families. The reasons why Sherem likely was a Nephite arise by elimination from the preceding discussion of whether Sherem could have been a Jaredite, a Mulekite, or a Lamanite. First, he was more likely a Nephite than a Jaredite, Mulekite, or Jaredite, because as a Nephite he would have had access to the scriptures that set out the law of Moses in which he was so well versed. Second, if he was a Nephite, it is less difficult to explain his eloquence and persuasiveness because the Nephite language and cultural tradition were his native element. If he was a Nephite, he need only have been an intelligent member of the small Nephite community. And finally, there were two male members of the original separated Nephite party whose names ended, per Nibley, with the letter M, Sam and Zoram. Perhaps, logically, more important in this, quote, process of elimination, end quote, is the absence of any need to explain Nephite connections with either the Jaredites or the Mulekites before the Book of Mormon text reports them. However, this logic does not signal any dispute with Professor Sorensen's well-respected belief that there were other peoples in the land where the Nephites and Lamanites and Mulekites came to dwell. Nor does the suggestion that Sherem was a Nephite require us to jump through hoops to explain why Sherem was so eloquent and persuasive in a language and religion that were not his own. What if Sherem was a Nephite? But if Sherem was a Nephite, does Jacob's record of their encounter, or any other part of the Book of Mormon text, provide us with any indication of which family he came from? The answer to this question is a qualified yes. The contextual keys that unlock an answer to this question include a close consideration of what Sherem taught. Sherem's doctrine is summarized in just two verses in Jacob chapter 7. While it seems obvious Jacob had no wish to give Sherem's heresies much airtime, he still recorded that Sherem objected to 1. Jacob's teaching as the gospel, the doctrine of Christ, and 2. Jacob's supposed perversion of the law of Moses into the worship of a being which ye say shall come many hundred years hence. End quote. Sherem's position boils down to his assertion that Jacob's teaching was, quote, blasphemy, end quote, since no one could know such things or indeed of anything that lies in the future. Sherem's doctrine bears a striking resemblance to the Jewish hopes that had turned prophecies of the coming Messiah into expectations of a second political David by the time that Christ was born among them in time's meridian. And this resemblance resonates with Jacob's earlier warning against Jewish stiff-neckedness, which, quote, despised words of plainness, killed the prophets, end quote, and generally had become blind by, quote, looking beyond the mark, end quote. Sherem may simply have been the most eloquent advocate of these Jewish doctrines with which Jacob had been wrestling for some time. Where did these doctrines come from if Nephi was as studious as he says he was not to teach his people, quote, many things concerning the manner of the Jews, since their works were works of darkness and their doings were the doings of abominations, end quote. Since it seems unlikely that Jacob and Joseph would have been less discreet with Jewish teaching than Nephite, someone else in the Nephite party must have known and taught it. Zoram presents as the most likely candidate. What do we know about Zoram? Zoram was the servant of Laban, who made covenant with Nephi and went down with him and Nephi's brethren into the wilderness. Brother Nibley's insightful observations about Zoram's faithfulness in keeping his oath to Nephi may, however, blinded us to the dilemma which Zoram faced when Nephi gave him a choice whether to come with him and his brothers, or, we presume, to stay in Jerusalem. The proverbial choice between Charybdis and Scylla. The absence of any satisfactory alternative for Zoram when Nephi gave him, quote, a choice, end quote, does not, however, mean that Zoram immediately changed his belief system so that it accorded with that of Lehi and his family. Nephi says that Zoram was the servant of Laban, quote, who had the keys of the treasury, end quote. It is unlikely that Laban had entrusted those keys to just anyone, for the treasury and the brass plates in particular were the tokens of Laban's wealth and station in Jerusalem. It is likely that Zoram was both a trusted servant and that he had some knowledge of the records of which he was custodian. Indeed, he may even have been a scribe to Laban. That he was politically knowledgeable is manifest from Nephi's record of their conversation as they took the records to Nephi's, quote, elder brethren without the walls, end quote. For Nephi says that while Zoram thought that Nephi was his master Laban, quote, he spake unto me concerning the elders of the Jews, he knowing that Laban had been out by night among them, end quote. How willing was Zoram's departure from Jerusalem? Logically, he had no choice. Even if he was not a captive, from the moment he realized that Nephi was not Laban, he must have perceived that he was in a catch-22 situation. If he did manage to escape from Lehi's four sons, the brass plates were gone and Laban was dead. Who would believe him if he reported the theft and its perpetrators? Was it not more likely that he would be taken as the murderer, thief, himself? And if Lehi's sons were gone without trace and Zoram held pending trial, what chance would he have to prove his innocence? Though Hugh Nibley says that Nephi and his brethren were safe in relying on Zoram's oath, it is doubtful that Zoram's departure from Jerusalem was completely willing, for the record implies that he had no chance to bid his family farewell. He was relinquishing a sinecure for a dubious nomadic existence in the desert, and if he was ad idem with Laban in this regard for Lehi and his family, he was being forced to fall in with a group of religious zealots. However, once Zoram left Jerusalem with Nephi, there was no return, for he was a fugitive from that moment on. If Laban was familiar with Lehi's teachings, then Zoram was likely familiar with them as well. But that does not mean that Zoram agreed with all of them. As Nephi's predecessor, as custodian of the brass plates, Zoram was likely familiar with the Jewish interpretation that had become orthodox in Jerusalem at the time of his departure, and may well have shared it with his family. Though he may have been personally loyal to and faithful to Nephi until the first Nephi died, it is likely that he taught his family other methods of scriptural interpretation and the mainstream Jewish idea which disclaimed a spiritual Messiah, especially one named Jesus Christ. Though Zoram may have been converted by the Spirit during the many years he heard Nephi teach and prophesy, that does not mean he did not teach alternative scriptural interpretation privately at home. Such teaching would easily explain the rise of an intelligent son or grandson who was well schooled in alternative methods of scriptural interpretation. Kevin Christensen's case that Sherem was a Mulekite Deuteronomist relies on the Deuteronomist's strict regard, quote, for the written law, end quote, of Moses. But Christensen's reasoning is just as valid if Sherem was a Nephite or an early Zoramite rather than a Mulekite. For even though we do not have enough detail in the Book of Mormon to confirm whether Sherem opposed the pre-Deuteronomic ideas that Elohim and Yahweh were separate beings, or that pre-Josiah high priests had a Melchizedek as well as an Aaronic priesthood role, it is clear that Sherem was completely wedded to the idea that the law of Moses was an end in itself and did not include any concept of an atoning Messiah to come. Zoramite religious practice. Commenting on an earlier and unpublished version of this article, John Welch observed that, quote, if Sherem was a Zoramite, then the rift between the Zoramites and the Nephites that erupted into warfare in the days of Alma had roots as far back as the contention between Sherem and Jacob, end quote. Certainly the most memorable catalog of Zoramite religious practices is that which Alma documented during his mission among them, more than 400 years after Sherem's ministry, and shortly after Alma had dealt with the latter Antichrist Korihor. Alma said that these Zoramites did not, quote, keep the commandments of God and his statutes according to the law of Moses, end quote. But it is likely that Alma meant that they did not keep the law of Moses as it was taught in the church established among the Nephites by his father, Alma. And the distinctive Zoramite prayers upon the Ramiumptum and Alma's criticism that they were prayers, quote, to be heard of men, end quote, unmistakably recall Christ's criticism of hypocritical Jewish religious practice by a people who purported to live the law of Moses and yet prayed to be seen of men in synagogues and on street corners. There is also a connection between the Zoramites and the Book of Mormon's most memorable antichrist, Korihor. Recall that Korihor met his final end in a road accident among the Zoramites. Though Mormon implies that the justice of God was manifest in Korihor's unfortunate end, it is fairly observed that the deaf and more vulnerable to pedestrian accidents than the non-hearing impaired. The point of the observation in this article is that if Korihor was living among the Zoramites when he died, he may have been a son of theirs who had returned to his own when he fell on hard times. Conclusion. Prophetic wrestling with Antichrist and others in the Book of Mormon who would not accept the law of Moses was intended as a schoolmaster to prepare them for the Redeemer's coming seems connected with the carried-over Jewish notion that the law of Moses was properly understood and followed as a simple precedential tradition. But it is surprising to find prequels to rabbinic theology in the Book of Mormon context when Nephi had been careful to censor them out. Finding these prequels in the Book of Mormon provides additional intertextual evidence of the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith could not have known of the work of the so-called Deuteronomic reformers in the 1820s, when scholars only started to grapple with these matters towards the end of the 20th century. Kevin Christensen has translated the Deuteronomic Reform literature for LDS consumption and has explained that it accords with the Book of Mormon teaching that many, quote, plain and precious things, end quote, were taken from the Hebrew Bible that has come down to us from the Jews. He has explained that Margaret Baker's particular insight that massive redactions in the name of a new orthodoxy immediately before and during the Jewish exile led to the rabbinic tradition that replaced the old theology and its core messianic teachings. Though it cannot be conclusively demonstrated from the current Book of Mormon record, there is circumstantial evidence that Sherem, that canon's first antichrist, was a son or latter descendant of Zoram who came out from Jerusalem with Nephi and his brothers after the death of Laban and the recovery of the brass plates. If Zoram had indeed preserved some of his memory of Jewish religious practice and doctrine and handed it down to his posterity, it is not surprising that there is resonance between apostate religious practice among the Nephites and that which Christ met and criticized during his mortal ministry. This has been a recording of Who Was Sherem? By A. Keith Thompson, published in Interpreter, A Journal of Mormon Scripture, Volume 14, 2015, pages 1 through 15. Read by Scott Dunaway. This audio recording is copyrighted under a Creative Commons license and may be freely distributed if it remains unchanged, the journal and its website are credited, and is for non-commercial use. A printed version of this and many other articles and resources on Mormon scripture can be found at mormoninterpreter.com.